right, everybody, I think we'll get started. My name again is Becky Mormon. I serve the village as co-pastor along with my husband Marcus. And Marcus and I have been here for almost 4 months. This is my second call. Before coming here, I served a congregation, a small congregation in redevelopment in Joliet, Illinois, while Marcus finished up his degree program at the University of Chicago. Before that, I went to the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, and before that, Valparaiso University, and before that, I hail from the East Coast, like Heather, native of Pennsylvania, was raised in upstate New York. So, from a little bit of all over. Come on in, ladies. Like I said, if you're one who likes to have a Bible, we will be reading some texts, and I invite you to take a Bible if that's something you like. If not, I'm going to be reading, and it's fine to just listen along. So, well, before we get started, I just wanted to say thank you all for being here. It's my great delight to be with you this weekend, as I know Heather feels that way too. So far, it's been just a delightful group of women, and I give thanks for your generosity and sharing and your vulnerability and your insight and wisdom. So, really, this is a joy. My presentation is called They Are Going to Mount Up with Wings Like Eagles. And we're going to be exploring situations like we began yesterday, kind of that conversation on powerlessness and how does renewal possibly come about in those most powerless of situations, and kind of picking up where Heather left off. So, today's game plan. I'm going to start us with an article that I have found very helpful. We're going to be talking about how renewal is not all salt baths and chocolate cake, and that article is kind of going to root us in the conversation of our time. So this article is something that came out last November, and gets kind of started in how are we talking about renewal, how are we inclined to think we can bring about renewal, what are kind of our go-to methods of this time. Then we're going to jump to looking at Sarai and Abram as a case study to map our journey towards renewal. We started with the theme verse in worship yesterday. I can't believe that was just yesterday. We started with Isaiah and the Israelites and their absolutely wreckage of a situation, which God still managed to bring about renewal. Today I want to look at a different text with Sarai and Abram. And then I'm a pastor, and I would also label myself a liturgist. And so we're going to be looking at one piece of the liturgy as for daily renewal, and then sharing some personal stories at the end. So that's where we're going. That's the trajectory of the next 50 minutes or so. So this article, it's entitled, This is What Self-Care Really Is Because It's Not All Salt Baths and Chocolate Cake. It's an article by a woman named Brianna West. It was published, it's a blog, and it was put out November 16th of 2017. And, I mean, this is not a scholarly article. This is not, it's just one woman's thoughts. But it was all over my Facebook. Young women, old women, pastors, professionals, massage therapists, like all kinds of people that I knew posted this article. So there's something about it that seemed to resonate. So I think that that's where it gets its validity, that we should talk about it. So I'm going to read you a section of this. And when you hear self-care, think renewal. Self-care is often a very unbeautiful thing. It is making a spreadsheet of your debt and enforcing a morning routine and cooking yourself healthy meals and no longer just running from your problems and calling the distraction a solution. It is often doing the ugliest thing you have to do, like sweat through another workout or tell a toxic friend that you don't want to see them anymore, or get a second job so you can have a savings account, or figure out a way to accept yourself so that you're not constantly exhausted from trying to be everything all the time, and then needing to take deliberate mandated breaks from living to do basic things like drop some oil in a bath and read Marie Claire and turn off your phone for a day. A world in which self-care has to be such a trendy topic is a world that is sick. self-care should not be something we resort to because we are so absolutely exhausted that we need some reprieve from our own relentless internal pressure. True self-care is not salt baths and chocolate cake. It is making the choice to build a life you don't need to regularly escape from. And that often takes doing the thing we very least want to do. It often means looking your failures and disappointments square in the eye and re-strategizing. It is not satiating your immediate desires. It is letting go. It is choosing new. It is disappointing some people. It is letting yourself be normal, regular, unexceptional. It is no longer using your hectic and unreasonable life as justification for self-sabotage in the form of liquor and procrastination. It is learning how to stop trying to fix yourself and start trying to take care of yourself. And maybe finding that taking care lovingly attends to a lot of the problems you were trying to fix in the first place. So those were just excerpts from this short article. But I think what resonated for me when I read that article and why I think so many people I knew put it up on Facebook and all over social media was because it names both our need for renewal, our need for self-care, our need for self-love, but then these disastrous ways we attempt to bring that renewal about. And it names some of those things, and I appreciate that. So that's kind of the world we live in. Does that resonate? So that's kind of the world we live in. For those of you who brought your Bibles and like to follow along, we're going to jump now to Sarai, Abram, and their insistence on taking things into their own hands. And I challenge you to sort of see if you can draw parallels between their story and this modern-day article that I just read. So we're going to start in Genesis 17. And this reading is the reading, I believe, for the second week of Lent. And we could have easily done almost every Old Testament story in the season of Lent for part of this Bible study. And at first I kind of was trying to go a lot of different directions, but for your sake, I'm just going to do one today. But anyway, so this is a story about Abram, Sarai, and their insistence on taking things into their own hands. All right. So Genesis 17, 1 through 7, and 15 through 17. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, "I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless, and I will make my covenant between me and you, and will make you exceedingly numerous." And Abram fell on his face, and God said to him, "As for me, this is my covenant with you. You shall be the ancestor of a multitude of nations." Remember, we're talking about a 99-year-old man here. "No longer shall your name be Abram, but your name shall be Abraham. For I have made you the ancestor of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your offspring after you." Jumping to 15. God said to Abraham, "As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall give rise to nations. Kings of peoples shall come from her." Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said to himself, "Can a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? Can Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?"
So, yeah, right.
They think the wife
is
younger.
Yeah.
Not much younger. So, this is an impossible situation. This is impossible that a 90-year-old would give birth to a child. And a couple of things about this text to kind of parse it out. So apart from just these two people's desire for children, in the time period where they're living, children play this remarkable role in a couple of ways. Number one, like, there's no nursing homes to send your old parents off to, so when you get old, you're gonna need kids. You know, it's nomadic, it's warring, so there's strength in numbers. So when you don't have kids, you're particularly vulnerable. When you don't have a big family to help you with the day-to-day life, that's a lot of work. But then also, so ancient Israelites did not have a worldview whereby you die and you either go to heaven or you go to hell. Ancient Israelites had a worldview where when you die, you go to the land of the dead, which is Sheol, which is neither good nor bad. It's just where everybody goes when they die. And in Sheol, your connection to the land of the living is dependent upon your offspring. So you're connected to the land of the living, which is the world we're living in, dependent on a lineage. So if you're 99 or 100 years old and you still don't have kids, this is highly problematic for so many reasons. So that's something you need to know going into this text. So this is this impossible situation. This is a ruin of a situation. These two people in great and terrible need and no way to bring it about for themselves. And yet God meets them with this promise that renewal will come and that a child will be born. And it's absurd. But that's not the whole of the story. Any of you who know the story of Abraham and Sarah, or Abram and Sarai, Abraham means the father of nations. So he gets a name that's going to fit his new reality. That's not the whole thing. Before this, if we go back to chapter 15, this isn't the first time God has come to Abraham and said, you're going to have a child. This is the second time. And the first time, I'll read this one to us. So after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. But Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me? For I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. And Abram continued, you have given me no offspring, and so a slave born in my house is to be my heir. But the word of the Lord came to Abram, this man shall not be your heir. No one but your very own issue shall be your heir. He brought Abram outside and said, look toward heaven and count the stars, if you are able to count them. Then he said to him, so shall your descendants be. And he believed the Lord, and the Lord reckoned it to him as righteousness. So we've got a promise. I mean, at this point, he's like 90. And this barrenness is a problem. God comes and gives a promise. But then, impatience. What happens next? I'm not going to read it. I'll just tell it. So Sarai gets a little anxious. I think we can challenge the writers here. There's a lot on Sarai, and it sort of makes Abram sound like he's just chill as a, you know, cool as a cucumber, and I just don't think that's probably the case. But anyway, so they get anxious because they're aging and it's still not happening. Time has passed. The promise has been made and time has passed. And it's not happening. So Sarah comes to her husband Abram and says, why don't you take Hagar, our slave girl, and why don't you get pregnant that way? It's not working out with me, so we need a child, we need that lineage, that connection, we need that, so why don't we take it into our own hands, and that's how we'll bring this reality about. And Abram says, okay, and that's what they do, and Hagar becomes pregnant, this young slave girl. Well, then, Hagar comes back pregnant, and Sarai begins this horrible shame cycle and says, she's looking upon me with contempt. I can't have this young girl who's pregnant. I'm old and have not been able to give birth, and I can't have her around. And so now Abram, he's got this young pregnant woman and this old wife who hasn't been able to conceive, and he has to send Hagar out into the wilderness. So now we have a barren woman, a man who is up a creek, and a pregnant woman in the wilderness. Tell me how this is good for anyone. And so now we've just taken a bad situation and making it worse, made it worse. So as I've titled it here, we started with a promise in chapter 17. We go backwards, we find another promise, and we find a royal botch job. I mean, this is a disaster with Hagar versus Sarah. And then at the end of that, where we've got all three of these individuals in dire crisis, that's where that original promise from chapter 17, that's when God makes the promise again. So we've got barren, promise. We've made it worse, promise. And then from the end of that second promise, the only difference between the first promise and the second promise is in the first one, God doesn't name Sarah as the wife, or as the mother. In the second one, God names Sarah as the mother. And then in chapter 21, I am going to read it because I think there's some really beautiful language in here. Chapter 21, 1-7. The Lord dealt with Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as God had promised. Sarah conceived and bore Abram a son in his old age at the time of which God had spoken to him. Abraham gave the name Isaac to his son whom Sarah had borne him. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Now Sarah said, God has brought laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. And she said, who would ever have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age. I love that last line. Who would have ever said that Sarah would nurse a child? So, this is a story of renewal out of an impossible place. But it's not a clear path to renewal.
What happened to Hagar?
Hagar, God promises, and that's back in chapter 16, God comes to Hagar, and God promises her, this is also good news, God promises to Hagar that she will give birth to many children, and she will be cared for, and he sends her home to Abram and Sarai, and says, this is not how this is going to go, you're going to go back there, you're going to be cared for, and you're going to be the mother of, I think, the mother of nations as well.
Sorry.
No. Good question. Excellent question. Yeah, there has to be renewal for Hagar too, or this is a very problematic story.
She found it.
I will so greatly multiply your offspring that they cannot be counted for multitude.
I will so greatly multiply your offspring. Yeah.
Where's that?
That was in chapter 16, verse 8.
So, let's take a moment and have a conversation. Maybe start with just a partner or just the people that you're sitting next to. We'll take a few moments. And how does renewal come about in this story? What is God's part in the renewal, and what is the human part in the renewal? So, is that prompt clear? Mm-hmm. All right, find a partner. And kind of go through, how does it all come about? So what I'm wondering is, could you share any of what you were just talking about in your small group or the whole group? What is the scope of renewal in this story? What part is God's? What part is ours? What helps you to understand renewal through this story? Anybody want to share anything? Or ask any questions?
Renewal, a new beginning for them.
The scope of renewal is birth and a new beginning. Whole new shape of their lives, even at this most late hour of their lives. Others.
We were wondering if it,
go ahead.
We were wondering if it's unusual to be that old without a second wife before Hagar.
Yeah, well, this is sort of a funny thing. When we get too literal about the Bible, it's like, It gets a little hairy back there, but anyway, so I mean, like, I don't know, Rachel and Isaac, or Rachel and Jacob and Leah, like, they were all a little triad there for a long time, so I don't know what was normal, but I don't think marriage as we understand it, one man and one woman, was normal in that setting. Oh, sorry.
We talked about that it involved God, something happening that the people couldn't make happen.
Something happening that the people couldn't make happen.
God could do something that the people couldn't, and then that it wasn't necessarily going to be the thing that the people thought it might be or wanted it to be. It was going to be God doing what God did, and they on that also were required to do what they had.
Yeah.
And that might not have been exactly what they wanted to do either, but it all ended up
nursing being here.
Yes.
And moving into our part in the present day, we went on to say that our part is not to write off something, a promise that seems impossible to us.
Not to write off a promise that seems impossible.
Because it's illogical, or it seems like all the doors are closed, or we're too old.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
I think Cindy said waiting. Our part is being able to wait. Mm. He came twice, and the wait was too long for them between the first and second visits. It's like, you're going to have a baby.
Right.
Well, it's 9 years. I mean,
yeah, it was a long wait.
Yeah.
And when you're that old, I imagine you're going to have a baby, I'd be willing to wait.
Yeah. I imagine that when you're that old, you're going, I don't exactly have 10 years to wait, you know. Other things.
Okay. Yeah, we kind of ended up focusing on how the human part in this story was, you know, trying to rush things along and take control, like you said, but that even that didn't block God's promise to come. Like that, it caused a lot of pain for everybody involved. But that didn't keep them somehow. It didn't make them ineligible for the promise.
Right. Right.
And that was encouraging.
Mm. Anything else? So any of you here who were here at orientation, Peg did a presentation and she drew a graph on a napkin. So I thought, well, then I can draw a graph as well. I've titled this The Arc of the Suffering of Sarah, Abram, and the Israelites, which a lot of the time is the arc of our suffering, which drives our need for renewal. So at the top of the arc, we have this unmet need. We have a wound. We have an insecurity. We have a suffering. So for Sarah and Abraham, it's infertility. It's barrenness. For the ancient Israelites, it's our country doesn't look like everybody else's. Our nation doesn't have all the stuff that other nations have. We have land, but we don't have a king, and we don't exactly have an army like everybody else, and it's this unmet need. If a warring nation comes at us, we're not going to have what we need, and God says, yes, you do, I'm your king, and it doesn't feel right to them. So there's this unmet need, which leads to discomfort naturally, of course. And then that discomfort, we all know this. Some of you might even experience this in the moments where we ask you to enter into a time of silence. It's like, oh gosh, this feels horrible, you know? And so we do things like immediately reach for our hymnals and start, you know, oh gosh, I need to pick out the opening hymn already. Or, you know, I mean, it's like there's just such a discomfort in that space. And so we do something. We have this impulsive, compulsive response to that discomfort, which usually looks like taking matters into our own hands, which for the ancient Israelites was, we want a king. We're going to do what it takes to get a king. Which for Abram and Sarai is the whole Hagar episode. And to go back to that article that I started us with, it's to procrastinate, to drink, to, I love Netflix, you know, just bury yourself in it, to who knows what. But then once we do that, the arc of this narrative with Sarah and Abraham takes us to rock bottom. Like, everybody now is in an even worse situation. But on the flip side of the rock bottom is, going back to yesterday's presentation, surrender. I think it was you yesterday, or one of you yesterday said, something about that place. I mean, you would think you would turn your back on God, because nothing has worked so far. But something about that place actually encourages receptivity and encourages an opening of hands, a crying out, a surrender, a turn towards God, because what do we have to lose? Everything else is taken from us. So we find ourselves at rock bottom, which sometimes induces surrender, which then, after the surrender has happened, we wait. Sarai and Abram, after that second time the promise comes along, they are in a place of waiting because God's promise is coming. And then, as Heather said yesterday, waiting actually becomes capacious. It actually becomes space. And in that space, things start happening. All kinds of things start happening. And that brings us back up to the top of the pit. And there's a baby. And there's a return to Jerusalem. And there's a rebuilding of a temple. And there's joy. And there's healing. And there's renewal. So that's the arc of the story that we read. I think oftentimes it's the arc of our suffering as well. So, what do we do? As I said, I love the liturgy that we get to participate in each Sunday. And as a pastor, a lot of times, if I'm stuck on something, I go back to the liturgy. And I want to propose that the song that we sing, the prayer that we pray sometimes in worship called the Kyrie, is the tool or one of the tools God has given us for that place. For we're up here, there's an unmet need, there's a wound, there's suffering. It's like this, it's uncomfortable and you just want to do something. Do the Kyrie. So let me say more. So I'm going to propose that Kyrie is a way of life. Kyrie is a means of renewal. So, just a show of hands. How many of you, when I say Kyrie, know what I'm talking about? Okay, so we'll do a little teaching as well. So, Kyrie eleison, means Lord have mercy. And this piece of the liturgy comes early on in our Sunday Eucharist service, oftentimes, not always. But the Kyrie goes like this. It begins with, in peace, let us pray to the Lord. And everyone sings, Lord have mercy, or Kyrie eleison. So we start with a desire for peace. So remember, we're back up at that like unmet need, that wound, that mess of a situation, that infertility, that, you know, whatever it is. We need peace. Lord have mercy. And not just any peace, the peace from above. The peace of God. And like, I don't actually believe that God lives in the sky, you know. I mean, that's an old understanding, but it's the way that our church has talked about things. But in other words, we don't just need any old peace. We need the peace that passes all understanding, which derives from God. We all know, I don't know where that line comes from, why do you cry peace, peace, when there is no peace? You know, and we all know that, like, oh, everything's good here. But it's not good. You know, I mean, we all know false peace. So we're at that brink. We need peace, not just any peace. We need the peace from above. Kyrie eleison. And then our desire spans out. We need that peace for the whole world, for the well-being of the Church of God and the unity of all. We need that peace across the board. I mean, think about our current world, the earth, threats. I said in my Christmas Eve sermon that this last year I had kids in my congregation who were like 14-year-old boys who weren't sleeping because they were so anxious about North Korea. You know, they're hearing things and they are terrified. So we need peace, the peace of God, peace for the whole world. Lord have mercy. And then the Kyrie brings us back to here. We need peace for this holy house and all who offer here their worship and praise. So we need peace for North Korea, for South Africa, for all over the world, and we need peace for Melissa and Mary and Diane and Becky and Heather and Charlie. We need peace now, here. Kyrie eleison. And then the Kyrie ends with these lines. Help, save, comfort, and defend us, gracious Lord. Amen. Now, if you're like me and you were raised on this stuff, it's just kind of in one ear, out the other. Or if you weren't raised on it, you're going like, why would you speak in that language? It's not English. But it's Greek, by the way. But this is good stuff. So what we have here is our deepest desire at the edge of that brink is for peace. All the specific peace for these people, for us. And then it's like the prayer does this to us. You want peace? You have to surrender these things. You have to surrender all the ways you attempt to help yourself, save yourself, comfort yourself, defend yourself. Those things we have to put down in order for peace, the peace of the whole world, the peace from above to come. So do you, I'm gonna save that for a minute. Do you see in the story of Sarah and Abraham? Yes, suffering happens. Powerlessness is real. There are circumstances that put our lives in that place of needing renewal. But then do you see how it's in the trying to help themselves and save themselves that like they become entrenched in the suffering? And how when they finally set that aside and enter into that open position of waiting, things start to actually happen. So before I go on, questions about that? Thoughts about that?
I'm wondering, I guess I'm thinking of, I'm wondering if rock bottom, if it always happens, and if when it doesn't in the life of a person, taking the matters into our own hands, I'm wondering if there are ways that we do that, ways to cope that are that we get so practiced in them, and so they sustain us kind of, but in a false way for a really long time. So we actually don't hit rock bottom. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, if we would let go, I'm just wondering if coping can prevent a rock bottom experience, and if renewal is not possible. Mm-hmm. That sounds really dim when I ask the question, but I've seen that happen a lot, coping can go a really long time.
Yeah.
And so I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about kind of that part of the arc.
So Heather's asking about our ability to cope being something that keeps us from renewal.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a little bit what's going on in that first article. We're awesome at coping. We're really, really, really good at it. We can live with a myriad of struggles and pains and no one will even know we're so good at hiding it or coping with it.
We forget ourselves that
yeah.
we have those pains.
Well, and yeah, we can. I love what you said. We can become so practiced in our coping mechanism that we forget that it's just a coping mechanism.
Right.
It just becomes us.
May I say something?
Yeah.
It would seem that a rock bottom sounds drastically something, but it can be a very small something.
Yeah.
An awareness that says this is not working.
Yeah. Rock bottom can be a different thing for any of us. Rock bottom for one marriage can be this isn't working and so we need to get ourselves to therapy and we need to, whatever. Rock bottom for others is this has to be done. Rock bottom for others is infidelity. Rock bottom is the lowest level you will tolerate or you can possibly tolerate. And that's going to be different for any of us depending on, think about a job. a job that one of us might stay in for a long time, another might leave immediately, you know. So I'm going to hold that tension, Heather, because that's really valid. And I don't want to answer it because I don't have an answer. But also, but also because, yeah, I think it would not serve us. But yeah. So I'm going on time. We're getting there. Okay. We're going to, oh, is there a hand?
We talked a little bit about discerning that place where how much of it is our part and how much of it is God's part when we come to a situation where we're in pain or in trouble. And I think it might, sometimes I wonder if it might be, you would take away the idea that we never have agency and that, and I know this is, when Peggy wrote that Nguyen quote, that clarifies it a little bit. But I'm wondering, is there a way to, I mean, is there, can we kind of look at our motives to figure out where that place might be?
Sure.
Like, are we trusting God or are we not trusting God?
Yeah. I like that you brought up agency.
Yeah, responsibility. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, because certainly we don't want to walk away from this weekend thinking like, well, we're powerless and there is no agency. Woof. Yeah. We don't want that.
That's what you start this talking about, the difficult stuff, right? That you actually have to do.
Yeah, right. There are things to do. So before we get to this last question that I've put up, one of the ways to look at this, which I didn't articulate, we're asking for these things. These are our deep desires. And we don't lay these things down forever. We lay them down, and then God gives them back. And it has to do with the ordering. If I barrel through,
I was thinking that there's, because I like to fix things and be in charge.
Oh, I'm a little experienced with this. Hi, my name is Becky. I like to fix things and be in charge.
When I do that, I become very unable to hear what God wants me to do. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's that realization that that I know I'm capable in certain areas and I know I can manage certain things. But it also narrows my ability to hear.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I'm the person running everything.
Yeah.
And for me, the surrender part comes when I hit that brick wall where all my ingenuity, all my training, all my personality can't fix this, can't make this happen. That to me is where the surrender comes in, and then it's like it opens up.
Yes.
And then I can hear, maybe my sister writes me a note and I go, oh yeah. Or you know, Dana says something, or somebody else says something. But if I'm so focused on me doing it, fixing it, managing it, mm-hmm. controlling it, I can't hear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Out here. So that to me is I don't think it means we stop doing stuff.
Right.
But I think it means how we approach it in
yes.
my mind is how do we approach it and really who's in charge and
yeah.
who am I listening
and
to?
It's
just my own voice or God?
Yeah. Yes, thank you. It's a relationship here.
Right.
And so I come to that point, I'm at that brink of that curve, it's uncomfortable. I have my instincts. My instinct is like I'm gonna micromanage the heck out of every moment of this, and I'm gonna be in charge, and I'm gonna uh-huh. and it's like not going to go well because the whole energy of the thing is you know, and so I go Kyrie eleison. Now my hands are like this, and then I receive work to do. I receive a way forward, which I am going to do, and participate in with my body and my skills and my being. So back to Sarai and Abram, you're going to have a baby. Great, that's what we've been wanting. Ooh, this is taking a long time. I think we'll do it our own way. Yeek, doesn't work out. Hey guys, remember, I'm going to give you a baby. It's going to be your own. It's going to be Sarah's. God gives them the work to do. they become the mother and father. They have a part to play. They have work to do. But do you see the ordering of it? When they get out in front, taking it into their own hands, it implicates more suffering, which, as Heather brought up, still isn't the end. Still isn't, in the grand scheme of things, that big of a deal. It all worked out, you know. But anyway, so all that to say, there's great agency in this for us. We set it down. We pray, God, help, save, comfort, and defend us. And God says, Cindy, this is what would help. Do this. Not, well, I'll just puppet string you and, you know, whereas maybe our own instincts might get us into trouble.
I think sometimes it's easier to give to God what the problem is if the result affects a bigger group. If what you're doing affects somebody else, it's easier to say, I don't know what to do here. Then it's affecting yourself personally.
Mm.
Because you think personally you can handle your own thing. But if the results are going to affect another person's life or a group of people, then sometimes it's things like, well, God, I can't do this. I can do me, but I can't do this big picture here for these other people.
Yes. The instinct to, like, we'll try this out if it's for the sake of others. But mm-hmm. if it's for us, like, nah, we can just muscle through. Yeah.
Becky, I'm a little confused about the term agency here.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never heard it in this context or have paid attention. Haven't listened to other
words. Agency, I would just say, is power.
Oh.
Your own power in the situation. Yeah, if I have agency, I have power. So that's all that means.
And responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Google it. Oh, no.
Yeah. Well, and I think some of this, too, is like yesterday when our little group broke up and talked about powerlessness, like there are actually these places where the most powerful of us, there is no power in when a loved one dies. I cannot stop that thing from happening. Nothing in my power will bring that back. And so to just jump to, no, I refuse for that to be the reality. I do have power. I am going to do something. I am going to help, save, comfort, fix, rescue, you know, whatever, kind of betrays the reality of things. Whereas in this surrender, which I would say that's what Kyrie is, it's a prayer of surrender, we actually receive power. We actually receive work to do. I should receive something to get going. So we're running short, so I'm going to go forward, but I want you to ponder, has there been a moment, a time, a thing, and probably there are multiple per day, if you're anything like me, where your attempt to help, save, comfort, or defend, or fix, or rescue has gotten you into trouble.
Yeah.
So think about that. I was going to break us up, but just ponder that and take it with you as you go. So I want to propose a different arc. Yes, this is the possibility of things. And like Heather brought up, I mean, it can go pretty low. But at any point, and this is your power, at any point, you can surrender. At any point, you can cry, Kyrie eleison, this isn't working. Lord, have mercy. And at any point, you can wait. And in that space, things will begin to shift and move and open, and you will experience renewal and joy and healing. So it can happen like, oh, I'm about to take things into my own hand. Ooh, I don't want to go there. Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy. Surrender. It can happen in the discomfort. It can happen in the original thing. So there is a discrepancy. We all have lived in that space of, this is not what I wanted it to be. This is impossible. This is painful. This is whatever it is. And I want for this to come about. But what happens in between, we have some agency. We have some power.
Where's the love?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Where's the line from rock bottom?
Well, oh, this is
the
line.
Normal one.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I want to tell you a story of how renewal met me on quite possibly the worst, hopefully the worst, but probably that's optimistic day of my pastoral career. So before coming here, I was a pastor in Joliet, Illinois. And in my second year as a pastor there, I had a member whose dad had died. He belonged to another congregation, and that other congregation, the funeral was at the other congregation. But the woman in my congregation, whose father this was, asked if I would be the pastor to attend to his burial. So he's cremated, the funeral was like 1 month, and the burial was a couple months later. And he was going to be buried at Abraham Memorial National Cemetery in just outside of Joliet. So it's this big, huge military cemetery where they have all of this. They have like their own service that they do. You get up to the gravesite, and there's a gun salute, and there's bugles, and there's bagpipes, and there's a flag presentation, and all this stuff. And then the pastor gives a prayer. So I don't have to give a homily. I don't have to plan anything. I just have to be there and say this prayer. So that's going to be on Wednesday. So Wednesday comes about, and because I have not had to write a sermon, because it's a month after the funeral, and because I am a scatterbrain and I carry a calendar but I don't always look at it, I was sitting there in the morning with my secretary, and we were talking through the day, and I just happened to reach down and look at my phone, and I had like 30 missed calls. And it was 10 o'clock, and I answer the phone, and it's the family, and this is the time of the burial, and it's 10 o'clock is the burial, and 10 o'clock is the time I'm looking at the phone. And I just like immediately like rush to my feet, I call them, I'm like, it's okay, I'm gonna be there, I'm gonna, you know, I just start with this impulse of, this is not the situation I think that it is, I promise it will be okay, I'm gonna get there. Then as I'm talking, I realize like it's a half an hour to get there, and this is such a busy thing, like I only have a 15-minute window, and there's no fixing this situation. And so I start like, oh, it's okay, I'll give you the prayer, and it's like, oh my gosh, this woman is burying her father, she doesn't want to do that, and this is a disaster, and I haven't shown up for these people, and I am absolutely at the brink, this is horrible, and they are, because I haven't shown up. And this is where the renewal met me. I literally walked into my office, and I just started like running circles, like I'm just going around my office like there surely is a book or something. There's got to be a way to make this better, something I can take into my own hands and make better. And that lasted for like a minute, and then it was very abundantly clear. Tell me there's nothing for you to do. So I closed the door, I sat down in my chair. And the things that we do in worship literally presented themselves to me. I had a hymnal sitting on my desk. And in worship, we do these things. We do Kyrie. We do confession and forgiveness, which is to say we bring that stuff that we have done wrong, and we lay it before God, and God says, you are my beloved, and you may begin again. So I sit there, and I did that, like waiting. I actually entered into the discomfort of it, and I sat still, and I opened my hymnal, and by myself there in my office, did confession and forgiveness, and opened my hands and cried, Lord, have mercy, because there is nothing else I can do. And I received forgiveness. I still have to wait. This is still painful. But the whole thing kind of brought me back down to stay where I am. Don't go down the thing. Just stay where you are. And eventually some of the shame lifted, and eventually some of the terror of the thing lifted. And then I was free to do the work that needed to be done, which was to call that widow and to apologize. And you know the kind of apology that's like, I'm doing this because I need you to forgive me because I feel so rotten. You know, like, I need your forgiveness because I need it. Well, I'm already forgiven.
I'm already in God's mercy, so I don't need anything. I have no unmet need now. I can present myself as a servant. And so that's what I did. I called this widow. I called the daughter. I mean, it's still terrifying because it's absolutely mortifying what's happened. And this beautiful thing happened where the widow, her name was Thelma, and I said, Thelma, I am beyond sorry. You deserved better today. And I just apologize from the bottom of my heart. And she goes, well, Pastor Becky, I guess we learned something today.
You know, like,
yeah, Thelma, what did I learn today? You know? She goes, I guess we learned that you're a person just like the rest of us who makes mistakes. And she said, Pastor Becky, I forgive you. Which was the icing on the cake. That it could have gone otherwise, and that would have been okay too. But it was such a kindness. So I would call that, it's the worst thing that I've ever done as a pastor. It's mortifying. It's utter failure. And yet I think there's something about that story that I tell because it's also a story of success, of moving from here to there without going in all of that mess, you know, of sitting and staying. And there's something of my power in it, and there's a lot of God's power in it. And it's this, what can come about when we work together in that way, moving in relationship instead of just, you know, salt baths and chocolate cake, which tastes good and feels good, but doesn't always get us where we want to go. So we're at noon, but I would challenge you to think about your own stories of successful surrender, because you have them. And they don't have to be colossal. They can be little moments. They can be big things. And they can have been surrender at any point along that line. But what are your stories of surrender? Because that's where we find our power, and that is what eventually moves us up and out into renewal. So we're at noon. We started 5 minutes late. If anybody has to go right now, go ahead. Otherwise, questions?
Becky?
Yeah.
I'm wondering where the grief fits into your arc.
Well, probably. Well, what would you say?
Probably the discomfort
is where the grief would come.
And maybe rock
bottom.
Huh.
Maybe
I was thinking it would be way more grass than Thomas.
I wonder if there is a grief all along. I mean, there can be grief at every point. You can surrender and still have grief. You know, you can be waiting and still have grief. The movement of the Holy Spirit can be happening and there can still be grief. So thanks for bringing that up. These are kind of thoughts that I'm putting together as I go. So that's really, because grief's a big part of that.
Right. Yeah, you do pretty well in that. That's what.
Yeah, we're saying it fluctuates.
Yeah,
it isn't like you just
grief.
Get grief is that comes and goes.
Mm-hmm.
And comes back.
Yeah.
Well, you could have lost the respect and friendship of that family. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a loss, and that would cause, and that grief. Even if you're forgiven, you would still have to
carry that.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. And it's, I don't know, maybe it's even possible to have arrived at the state of renewal. And at times, you're still going to have grief.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
Others, thoughts, questions?
Sure.
How do you differentiate between taking matters into your own hands or allowing your skill sets to service the need?
How do you differentiate taking things into your own hands from using your skill set to serve the need? Yeah.
I mean, Sarah did that, but I mean, because in that culture, Hagar would have been a natural substitute. So that wasn't, I mean, it wasn't like she said, her thought process could have possibly been, well, maybe this is what God needs me to do to get him to have an heir. I mean, maybe, you know, that was, it would have been a logical.
Yes. Yeah.
Hopefully it would have been logical to do that.
Mm-hmm. I think Heather and I have talked a bit, you know, it's not true that there's always just like, well, our way is just the pits, and God's way is, you know, the way. At our deepest level, those things are aligned. And when we are moving in the Spirit, we are most fully ourselves and most fully in relationship with God. You know, and so it's not to say, like, well, ladies and gentlemen, you know, you never know what's, you know, you never are, your instinct is always going to be off your, you know, whatever. At that, do you want to say any more about that, Heather?
Yeah.
Kind of alignment?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, what was, I would point back to what Cindy shared, because what struck me when you shared, Cindy, is that you knew, something in you knew when you weren't listening. And I think that, but you could have
right.
That resonated with you, and right. Maybe sometimes. So we always have the option of resisting something.
Yeah.
Okay, but I just was like, okay, something in, and I think that's God's. That's part of the work of God's Spirit in us in these discerning moments, right? Something, and some. It may take a while to get there, and sometimes we'll miss it. And then we'll look back and we're like, oh my gosh, I was tunneling there. Or, oh my gosh, you know, I wasn't listening there. But I think that's one of the graces, is that God's Spirit in intermingling with our own gives us the gift of listening and knowing where the truth lies. And that takes work sometimes, takes practice maybe, and we need others for that. But that's when I hear your question, I thought of what Cindy shared. Nothing is black and white.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes if I can remember a time when I was thinking, oh, I should write that person a note. And I thought, oh, that'd be dumb. And then I thought, I really should tell him that. And I thought, I really should write that note.
Mm.
And so that it kept coming to me, and I did write the note, and I did get a thank you the next morning saying, that's exactly what I needed to hear.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it wasn't like, I'm gonna fix this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, I felt drawn to do something, and by the time I finally did it, it wasn't me doing it, it was knowing it was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Or a necessary thing.
But I think in the waiting times too, there's quiet times. And I'm not really good about understanding whether it's me getting my own way or God really encouraging me to get what I think is my own way. But he needs help. But Bill's heard me say this more than once. But it's when you wait, you stop what you're doing, you just kind of reflect on what's happening. And you're closer to God at that point because you're allowing God in to tell you some things. Now, I'm a great note writer. I love to write notes. People have said exactly what this lady said. I appreciated the note. It came at a time I needed that. I have written to teachers that I had, unfortunately too late for most, but I don't mean I wrote to them after they died, but it's like
that's what it sounds
about
like.
A favor. I know,
yeah,
I had to clarify
that.
But you have to remember that people in the here and now need to hear from you. And they don't need to hear from you on social media. They want your voice or they want what you have written. So but I go to the quiet moments, and I have to, a lot of what I say and reflect on are what I need to do personally and what I try and do personally.
What I heard in some of that was, you know, waiting, that little bit of space we can give either in the moment or in a season, or by coming to a retreat, that little bit of space can break up our response from being reaction to being response. Mm-hmm. And reaction is rarely our truest self. Mm-hmm. And response can be. And true self is in line with God's self. And so, yeah.
So maybe there's a little potential waiting or pausing zone between discomfort and take matters.
Yeah.
That could be help reorient going down or going left.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that can be anywhere, at any point, a little waiting.
Yeah.
Little, yeah. So, all right, we have come to the end. I am grateful for you, and thank you.